speaking on the issues that impact. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We are live and direct for the next 2 hours here on TNT Today's News Talk. Thank you so much for joining us. And a big thank you to everybody in our TNT chat community. We see you guys piling in there. We see the numbers growing day by day as we move into this new time slot here on the network. We really appreciate you guys, especially everybody in Europe and the UK. Because we're on a later time slot, we realize we've had to migrate some of our listeners and viewers over, and really appreciate the positive feedback we've gotten from a lot of you. It means a lot to us. Keep the messages coming in the chat room and via email as well. Now, we have a powerful show today. We've got a lot of important stories that we're going to cover. There's a big breaking story regarding Burisma in Ukraine and connections to the terrorist attack at Crocus City Hall in Moscow. As you remember, we were there in Moscow in the vicinity when that happened, and I did file a report for RT International at the time, and some of this skepticism I had about this being an ISIS attack, well, and others too, turned out to be true. So we've been vindicated based on our early analysis, but there's a whole lot more to this story as it unfolds. We'll give you the details. We'll cover this in the second hour. We're also going to be joined the second hour by a great voice from the United States, Dustin Stockton, who's going to give us an update on what looks like potentially a shakeup in the 2024 election, possibly on the Democratic side. We're also going to look at the Donald Trump campaign. Where are they at right now with the lawfare, with the vice presidential pick? All of these things are big question marks hanging over that side of the election. We'll see what happens. The results of this, nobody quite knows how it's going to go. All we know at the moment is this is one of the most bizarre election cycles in modern history in the United States. So looking forward to catching up with Dustin from America Mission. He'll join us in the second hour. In the first hour, we're going to get right to it. There's a lot going on right now in the Middle East. The recent attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus has triggered an additional vector of potential escalation in the region. That is when Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus, and Iran has promised to retaliate, but only at a time of its choosing. And when it decides to do that and how it decides to do that is really up to the Iranians. However, there are recent reports of communications with the United States, back-channel communications with the U.S. between Tehran and Washington about what they expect from the situation in Gaza and how what happens there in terms of is there going to be some kind of a sustainable ceasefire. That's going to determine whether or not Iran retaliates directly against Israel for what they have done, effectively hitting sovereign territory. Embassies and diplomatic facilities are regarded by the Vienna Convention as sovereign territory, lest we forget, although some seem to have forgotten, or maybe these rules and international treaties don't apply to some actors in the international system, namely Israel, with the backing of the United States. Now, to talk about the current situation and try to put this into perspective and get some important details, I want to welcome onto the program veteran journalist from the Middle East, Leila Haitoums, joining us from Lebanon. She has also been to the front lines in southern Lebanon, so she is extremely familiar and adept at what is going on. She'll share some of her observations and her analysis with us right now. Leila, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Patrick, and thank you for having me back over here. I'm loving this new time slot. It gives me time to prepare.
I know you're very busy during the day. I know you you do a lot of work on the ground in the region, so we really appreciate your time, Leila. And how have things changed in the last week? This attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus can only be viewed really as a provocation. It is really stepping over a major red line in terms of precedent. But is this a provocation that Israel expected a retaliation for, or is just this recklessness on the part of Tel Aviv? What's your view on this?
Well, the thing is, things have changed drastically since the Israeli occupation's attack, airstrike actually, against the adjoined building to the to the Iranian embassy in Damascus. But you have to understand that this is not a precedent. The Americans have done it before, and several other nations have done it before as well against embassies, be it in Europe or basically in the Middle East or in North Africa. So there has been at least 4 to 5 incidents that I can count on top of my head when it comes to this matter over the past 30 years. What the Israelis have done is unacceptable under international law. It's a war crime. It's a breach to Geneva Conventions. Some people look at adjoined buildings as basically an extension of the embassies themselves, that they are sovereign territories. However, they, even if they are not a sovereign territory, they do enjoy the immunity given to diplomatic missions. So it's a direct attack on a diplomatic mission. They killed one of the top generals when it comes to the Iranian military. And that person, General Zahedi, was the head of the Al-Quds Brigades. And this person had been training and helping out the axis of resistance for decades. It's not basically for the recent years. So what changed on the ground, and I can tell you basically from the southern Lebanese front, the Israelis basically changed their formation in terms of fortifying certain areas that they actually take in bunkers or had new headquarters or outposts in. At the same time, limited, if barely any, movement in the second tier and third tier settlements all the way to Rosh Dan. The Israelis have moved air defense systems. They have shifted their air defense systems to protect certain larger settlements they have, especially basically around Rosh Dan. And they have moved also some of the air defense systems all the way down to Umm Rashash, which they call Eilat, which is right across Al-Aqaba, which overlooks basically the Red Sea. Now, there are talks in the media, yes, that possibly the Iranians and the Americans are talking, and there's a possibility of the Iranians relinquishing, retaliating to this heinous crime in exchange of a ceasefire in Gaza. However, this is not true. According to my own sources on the ground, and I do have sources not only from the Iranian side, but also from the Axis of Resistance side, this talk or this kind of talks never happened. They've never materialized. This is just propaganda. The Iranians had vouched during a press conference that was held in Damascus by the ambassador himself that the Iranians will retaliate, and they will retaliate according to their own time, where they see fit and when they see fit. So the idea is that the Israelis are now preparing for that. And we recently heard the deputy chief of the Israeli military basically telling Harel, basically telling the settlers at one point or another, especially in Rosh Dan, to prepare and stock up on food, medication, and water, as well as set up their landlines, because they might be going into war with North Lebanon, which insinuates that the Israelis have been pushing towards that war, and they're basically pulling Iran into it so they can actually have an excuse to go into that war.
I think you've brought up a good point there. When I saw this initial reports, a lot of people were tweeting about this. It's this back channel, third party message between Tehran and Washington. I kept looking for the source and I couldn't find it. And I'm always very suspicious when I can't see it. And so then is this then at that point, internet chatter? If that's the case, Layla, and maybe you could speculate, if you will, I'll give you free range to speculate here, who would have put that information out? And maybe for what reason? Do you have any thoughts on that possibility?
Usually, we've seen it. I mean, I've been a reporter for only 22 years, right, covering this region. But usually, we see this happen when the Israelis are trying to test the waters, or the Americans are trying to test the waters with the suggestion that they will bring to the table right before negotiations happen. And this happened right before the negotiations table, the most recent round that actually failed as well. When some people say that it didn't fail, it actually failed miserably. They have reached no solution. The Americans might have put it out just to test the waters. But I can tell you one thing. I also saw it in regional Arab, actually GCC allies of the US media outlets. So the media outlets that belong to certain states that are allied with the US have also ran similar stories based on sources close to Iran, sources close to Hezbollah, and basically sources close to the Axis of Resistance without naming them. And at one point, one of them had the audacity to go and run a whole story based on a higher up source from Hamas. And everybody was on the ground laughing, because we know that Hamas would never speak to that media outlet at all. So the idea is that they were testing the waters, trying to stir the regional sentiment over here, that Iran refused at one point or another to pass it. It's like they passed on a chance for ceasefire because they were adamant at revenge. This is how they're going to play it. So the idea is like, I mean, the U.S. is going to go out and say, like, we tried our best, but the Iranians retaliated and they want war. So it's Iran's fault that war happened, not because the Israelis actually bombarded and killed an Iranian diplomat and member of the military who was found inside the premises of the Iranian embassy, basically in Damascus.
The danger, of course, just with this move, attacking a diplomatic facility or a property like that, is it lawlessness basically ensues in the international community. And just a few days after that, the Ecuadorian authorities raided the Mexican embassy where the Ecuadorian former vice president was taking refuge. It's caused a huge international incident. And they can just point to Israel, or they can point to Britain abducting Julian Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy and say, hey, you know, these rules no longer apply. This is the danger, of course, as we're getting into this area here. But more than that, with regards to Israel, it's kind of accepted, Leila, that they're in a very desperate situation on so many different levels, tactically, strategically, politically. They've lost the court of public opinion internationally now. They are a pariah state. And Benjamin Netanyahu, clearly his mandate only extends as far as there's a war going on. As soon as there's a ceasefire or anything like that, he's out the door. So isn't it true maybe that there's an incentive by the Israelis to draw the United States possibly into a conflict with Iran somehow, or to create an international incident that would draw the U.S. closer during an election year into some deeper level on this conflict? Is that possibly the motivation for what we saw in Damascus last week?
Well, it's a mutual interest and mutual beneficial relationship between the Israelis and the U.S. at the moment. Bibi Netanyahu needs this war to continue so he can actually stay in power. Anytime this war ends, there will be basically a trial against him that's brought against him, and everything that he has done in the past will be dragged against him in the court of law, right? So he fears that day. That's the first thing. He hasn't achieved any victory on the ground that he can actually stop this war and go to his people and say, like, but I gave you this and I gave you that. That's why he's trying to annex North Gaza, to tell his people, at least I gave you North Gaza. Or he's basically trying to annex further lands inside the occupied Palestinian territories. I mean, for the past 30 years, now we're witnessing the largest land theft and annexation within the occupied Palestinian territories by the Israeli occupation. And the world hasn't moved a single finger to stop them. And those are the territories that even the United Nations say that they are occupied Palestinian territories. It's not like part of the Israeli entity. But to look at it, I've said it from day one. It's not the Israeli war against Palestinians or people in the region, as much as it's basically a U.S. war against Russia. You have a war of proxies, as we call them. Some people are a bit sensitive to the word proxy, but proxies are usually the smaller groups rather than basically when we're talking about regular armies or larger armies or states, right? So this war of proxy, the Americans have been dancing around with the Russians across the world, including in the Middle East, for the longest time. For the past 4 years, 5 years almost, the Americans and the Russians have been fighting over energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean region. The Russians have been extending their own energy pipeline from the east to the west, basically through Azerbaijan, Turkey, to Central Europe. And the Americans had, at one point or another, another pipeline to rival it, coming from the GCC to the Eastern Mediterranean. We're talking about Egypt and Israel, towards Cyprus and Greece, all the way to Europe. Whoever controls the energy resources that goes to Europe controls the European decision-making. And if you remember, I had mentioned it before, Jeffrey Feltman, the former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, the one who was responsible for the file for the Horn of Africa, the same guy who used to advise Hillary Clinton when she was the Secretary of State, he was advising her on Middle Eastern affairs. He's the one who stood in front of the Congress 4 years ago and said, we have to beat Russia to the energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean region before Moscow beats Washington to it. Like, we have to actually beat them. So this dance has been ongoing for the past 4 years. The Americans need this war for three main reasons. Their economy is in shambles. No matter what positive information or data that they give out, economic data, their economy is in shambles. Inflation is still high. It's a source of worry. The parity for the dollar is not as strong as it used to be inside the U.S. You have higher unemployment rates, higher homeless people. So all of that creates pressure. And their debt is increasing. It's beyond $32 trillion now. So the idea is that if you look at all of that, the U.S. needs this kind of war. The second thing is it's a year of elections. And each side is trying to push at one point or another to show that it's on the constituents that they are doing something on the ground. And the third point is that the moment the Israelis actually kneel, because they have lost massively during this war, not only human capital, but also in terms of basically damages, economic and financial. So the idea is that the Americans will be waltzing in to tell the world, we are the ones who saved the Americans. And this is basically a positive point at one point or another. This is how the Americans see it, in terms of showing their constituents that we saved the Israelis after we depleted everybody's resources in this region, including the access of resistance. So the whole idea is that the Americans won this war. They kept on the Israeli greed, Bibi Netanyahu's greed. Actually, his name is Benjamin Mediakowski. He changed his last name to Netanyahu to fit into this region. He's not part of this region, he's part of Eastern Europe. So Benjamin Netanyahu actually has greed in terms of annexing more land to create the larger or greater Israel that he dreams of, that his radical constituents dream of, that Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, one of the cabinet ministers in the past, actually is dreaming of achieving. And all of that together, basically, is the Israeli greed that Bibi Netanyahu is capping on to create that war and annex more or further Palestinian land. We saw him trying to annex northern Gaza. He's trying to do a military operation in Rafah, or maybe basically diverting our attention towards Rafah. He keeps threatening of an operation over there, but at the same time, he's annexing larger lands, larger plots of lands in the occupied Palestinian territories, the largest ever in the past three decades. So the whole thing actually fits. And as I said, it's a symbiotic relationship. The Israelis won this war for their own greed and for Bibi to save his hide in terms of facing his people. At the same time, the Americans won this war to control energy resources in this region, build their military base in the Eastern Mediterranean region to rival the Russian military base in Syria and Hamimim, and at the same time, control the energy resources in this region.
And also, I want to ask you, what about the Israel's basically, all indications are that they have a plan for Gaza, and that plan doesn't look like it entails Palestinian residents. Everything is pointing to a policy of ethnic cleansing and killing the population there. I mean, at some point, we don't have to debate this, looking at the devastation that we're seeing. Look at how they're trying to partition north and southern Gaza, trying to create military facts on the ground here. So can we conclude that Israel has, the Israeli society, not just Netanyahu, look at the polling, they support this operation in Gaza. The Israeli society as a whole does not want to deal anymore with the Palestinian, the native Palestinian population, as it stands in Gaza. We'll get to the West Bank later, but is that safe to assume? I don't want to sound hyperbolic, but at this point, it's not looking good. What are your thoughts?
Nothing about war looks good. That's the cardinal rule. Nothing about war looks good. But in terms of polling, you shouldn't be trusting anything coming out from the Israeli media at the moment, because they are under heavy editing by the Israeli military itself. They passed a law about 6 to 7 days ago, if you remember, that actually puts more censorship on the Israeli media. They cannot put out anything that has to do with this war without it passing through the scissors of the military. And at the same time, the military itself had been imposing this kind of censorship since December, since basically before Christmas 2023. So for the past 3 months and a half, 4 months, if you look at it this way, you cannot trust the polls that they give out. I know for a fact from my context behind enemy lines that there's a massive divide among the population in Rojdan, at least, which has the largest constituencies in terms of the ones who have the financial powers in the Israeli entity. They are divided when it comes to the current government and the war in Gaza. They don't want to see further war. They have been hurt by the attacks, not only from the Northern Front, from Hezbollah's side, but also from southern Lebanon, but also from the Iraqi resistance, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, who had been sending basically their drones over to Gaza. They hit Netanya and other areas as well, and Ashkelon and Ashdod, among other settlements. So they are fed up with that. The ones who are actually pushing for that war are the radicals, mainly the armed radicals, not only basically in the settlements around the Gaza enclave settlements, but also in the occupied territories, the illegal settlements found there. We're talking about 900,000 radicals who are heavily armed to the teeth by Itamar Ben-Gvir and other radical ministers. So those are the ones who control the polling at the moment in terms of the numbers they want to put out or not. So I don't trust their polling. They are heavily divided when it comes to them being a society. That's the first thing. But you are 100% absolutely right when it comes to ethnically cleansing the land. The Israelis did not shy away from showing the world that they are going to starve the Palestinians, at least in North Gaza, to death or to push them out from North Gaza. And if you looked over the past 3 months, the Israelis had built a heavily fortified line that cuts North Gaza from the rest of Gaza. And that line is called the Netzarim Corridor. We've spoken about it multiple times. One of our colleagues, NY Plaid, had written about it extensively, and his articles are found on Twitter. Soon enough, they're basically going to be on a website that we're preparing for them. And at the same time, that corridor bans any aid from reaching North Gaza by land that's coming from South Gaza and Central Gaza. What they're doing is also creating a scorched land of about 3 kilometers from the Netzarim corridor southwards that nobody can approach, which means they're eliminating Central Gaza at one point or another. And today we saw the Israelis ramping up their attacks on Central Gaza, especially in the Nusayrat camp, and they've committed another massacre over there. Any aid that manages to cross with an Israeli green light from central south to Central Gaza towards the north, the Israelis bombard it the moment it reaches the North Gaza. And they kill with it tens to hundreds of Palestinians, hungry Palestinians, unarmed civilians who have approached these trucks to actually receive some of the aid. The aid that is being airdropped to certain areas in North Gaza by the Jordanians and by other entities are also subject to the Israeli sniping. The Palestinians who run over to actually pick up those aid are being sniped by the Israelis every now and then. Tens of people have died because of the Israeli sniping. When people are going, they go to actually pick up humanitarian aid that's being airdropped, as well as hundreds of civilians. We're talking about over 600 now, by now, the numbers. The series of flower massacres since February until now has basically exceeded 600 martyrs, mostly people under the age of 18. Those who don't have, basically, they belong to families that have lost the father, lost uncles, so they send in the children to bring that kind of aid. And today we had one of our reporters, not reporters, he's one of our colleagues who used to live in North Gaza, told us about one of his neighbors. He's 15 years old. He went over to pick up some of the aid from the trucks that arrived to North Gaza at the Kuwait roundabout. And this is where the first flower massacre happened, if you remember, 2.5 months ago. He was shot and killed by the Israeli snipers. When his uncle came to help him, he was also shot. The mother later on tried to save whatever was left to save, and she was also shot. This is the kind of thing that they're doing. They're ethnically cleansing the land, terrorizing people, bombarding them, killing them, starving them to move out or actually die in their place. If that's not ethnic cleansing, I don't know what is.
And I might add, everything that you're saying, much of it has been caught on camera. And those videos are publicly available. So this isn't like, anecdotal reporting or anything like that. This is absolutely factual. So it seems like then North Gaza, in terms of the Netanyahu government, the regime, this is a big prize. They have to show that they have cleared out North Gaza and that they are in total control of it. That seems to be a short-term strategic, political, if you will, prize for Netanyahu and the Israelis.
It's not only North Gaza. This is where people get it wrong. The Israelis have already annexed more than 17% of the Gaza Strip by taking around the whole peripheries. They have created a buffer zone, a military buffer zone across around all of Gaza, all the way from north to south, around the peripheries, from north, eastwards to southwards. And this strip of land amounts to 17%, and it's even more than 17% if you actually also count the Netzarim corridor that they have annexed and dividing basically the North Gaza from Central Gaza. So they have already taken that land. And when the Israelis tell you that, oh, we withdrew all of our troops from the ground and we only left one battalion, this is not true. They repositioned their battalions to the annexed territories. So they are, in fact, still inside Gaza, and they continue to bombard it by airstrikes and through that battalion.
Right. So all those statements about them withdrawing from Gaza, complete public relations, right? Just not factual at all.
True. They did it basically shortly before the negotiations started for a reason. So they can actually tell the world, well, we withdrew from Gaza, but Hamas refused to actually accept some of our terms. And this is why the negotiations failed. It's because Hamas did not agree, whereas Hamas had given only two conditions for them to agree to a ceasefire. Basically, the return of the release of all of the detainees and the complete withdrawal of the Israelis from all of the Gaza Strip. The Israelis until today have refused to comply with any of those two demands. And you have to understand that the Israelis have ramped up their detention of Palestinians, not only from Gaza, but also from the West Bank, from the occupied Palestinian territories. We are now approaching 10,000 detainees. Hundreds of children and women are being detained also by the Israeli occupation forces. God forbid what they're doing to them. We've seen cases of rape, sexual harassment, torture happening over the past 6 months. And I'm not talking about basically the past decades. These are all documented. These are all documented. So I feel sorry for the kids who are 8 years olds and 10 year olds and 12 year old who are being detained by the Israeli occupation forces. For what? For what? Why would you detain an 8 year old child?
Well, you have an authoritarian regime that's now paranoid about any dissent, any opposition, and there's going to be plenty of opposition now that people have witnessed what's happened in Gaza for 6 months. So they're in an absolute conundrum that is not a winning, equation for Israel, but it's especially bad for the Palestinians who just don't have anybody really to defend them in this particular situation. We're going to talk about this and more, and I want to go to the bigger geopolitical questions as well. We're here with veteran journalist Leila Haitoum, based in the Middle East. We're talking about Israel, Palestine, Gaza, Iran. We're also going to talk about U.S. and Russia. As Leila said, there's a proxy war going on. We'll discuss that too on the other side. I'm Patrick Henning. And this is TNT Today's News Talk. We'll be right back after these messages.
TNT's David Curtin.
It seems to me a complete and utter waste of time and money for Police Scotland to have to go and investigate every single report of what somebody says is stirring up hatred when that is not even properly defined in law. The police should be going after real crimes. Murder, rape, assault, arson, burglary, fraud, pickpocketing, vandalism. Those are the things that police should be dealing with and trying to make life safe for ordinary Scottish people, not pursuing them for what someone says they don't like somebody else says on the internet or on television or even in a comedy performance.
David Curtin on today's News Talk. TNT, a better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. The Net Zero Con will leave millions of citizens dependent on state handouts. It isn't a theory. It's an agenda. There is no climate emergency. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back to this live broadcast. We're still in hour number one here at TNT Today's News Talk. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show. This is Tuesday. We appreciate your listenership, your viewership, and a big thank you to everybody in our TNT chat community. I see some familiar faces in there. Great to see some of the usual suspects. So we'll be watching the chat room later in the show. Right now, however, I want to welcome back onto the program Leila Haitoum. She is a veteran journalist based in the Middle East. She has also frequented the front line in South Lebanon. She is very well in tune to what is going on the ground, but also regionally. Now, Leila, before the break in our previous segment, you talked about that there's also a proxy war going on. So let's zoom out geopolitically here. I tend to agree with you. There's two things that have happened in the last month I'd like to get your comment on regarding the Russian Federation. One of them is Russia holding these multilateral peace talks or dialogue talks with the Palestinian resistance factions in Moscow just a few weeks ago. That I want you to comment on this, because this is also unusual. The second thing is Russia repositioning some of its battalions to the Golan Heights or in that vicinity. So this is, to me, looking like Russia is kind of putting a more firm hand down, potentially. And is this the case of now, rather than previous decades, major decisions or major moves ran through Washington, or now there seem to be more things running through Moscow regarding the Middle East here? And I know this is also a result of Russia moving into Syria in October 2015 at the invitation of the Syrian government, of course, and how that's also changed a little bit the geopolitical reality in the region. But on those two items, I want to get your comment on those. Go ahead.
Well, some people find it a surprise that the Russians held these talks a few weeks back with the Hamas and PIJ representatives at one point or another. But you have to understand, it's no surprise to the people who have been following this from day one, from October 7. Remember what Hamas did. They sent their political arm outside, their political representatives, to Doha and to Moscow, and delegated both to negotiate in their name when it comes to any possible negotiations going forward. So Moscow had been delegated from day one, and Moscow had been following up on this from day one. Now, the bigger picture, if you want to look at it, I wouldn't basically be looking at those kind of talks between Hamas and the Russians, because I do believe that what the Russians taught Hamas is that we will support you no matter what. I would go back to the attack that happened in Moscow, the terrorist attack that killed hundreds and maimed hundreds of people over there. Remember what Putin said, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact words. He said, we will not allow anybody to tamper with our extended, with the security of our extended interests. When he speaks about extended interests, that means their allies abroad. And their main interest abroad, where does it lie? At the foothold of the warm waters of the Mediterranean. And we're talking about Syria. The only Russian military base in the Mediterranean is basically found in Syria, Al-Humaymim. And it's right across from the British military base in Cyprus. And it's right across from the death port, the floating port that the Americans are intending to build. And they have spoken about it. And they're sending 1,000 troops to build in front of Gaza. So the idea is that there will be a military base for the Americans over there to counter the Russians. And when that attack happened in Moscow, Putin actually drew the red line, moved 10 battalions along the southern Syrian front, which is basically the occupied Golan Heights that the Israelis have been trying to annex for years, but against international law, because international bans them from annexing somebody else, another country's land. And basically the Russians told the world in that move that we are ready to go into this war on the side of our allies. That means the Syrians and the Iranians, in larger sense, the axis of resistance. Otherwise, they wouldn't have moved their battalions over there. And remember with two things. The Syrians have Russian air defense systems that are very accurate, and they've downed a Falcon plane in the past, an F-16 for the Israeli Air Force in the past. They have downed other F-16s by Turkey at the beginning of this war back in 2011, 2012, if you remember, shortly before that war on Syria started. And at the same time, they managed to down one of the missiles that came that was launched by the Israelis against Beqaa in Lebanon, Janta, the area called Janta. The Syrians downed that missile by their air defense systems, which means they are ready and they are using accurate air defense systems. Now add to it the air defense systems that are brought by the Russians. So far, we've seen the Syrians use the S-200 and the S-300, basically air defense batteries. We haven't seen them use the new ones, the S-400, which they received a few years back. Where did this go? Nobody knows. At the same time, Hezbollah showed recently by downing a multi-million dollar Israeli drone over South Lebanon, using basically an air defense system that nobody knows what kind of missile they used. So there's also a big question mark over here. Are the Russians giving air defense systems to other axes of resistance, the Lebanese at one point or another? Nobody knows. So the Russians are defending their extended interests, which is basically the Eastern Mediterranean, their interest in that region, and they're defending it against the US axis, which includes the British and the Israelis. And this is where basically Iran enters. Iran is one of the allies when it comes to Russia, and they can attack from another side. There are the Yemenis. And this is why we saw basically the Russians and the Chinese going over to talk to the Yemenis. There were talks at one point or another that they could possibly also extend them air defense systems. Imagine now the Yemenis with air defense systems. I mean, like with the $5,000 missile, they managed to drown billion-dollar ships and basically multi-million-dollar drones. So you can imagine what kind of damage they can do to the American and the British military or Navy, basically, in the Red Sea and in the Arabian Sea as well.
This is interesting, Leila. You know, up until this point, there's been this kind of deconfliction agreement, really, between Russia and Israel. As we know, as anybody who follows this region knows, Israel has been hitting Syria almost on a weekly basis for the better part of 10 years, hitting their airports, hitting what they claim are military facilities or Hezbollah targets or Iranian targets. And Russia seems to be tolerating this so long as Russian assets aren't touched in these attacks by Israel. But as this conflict geopolitically extends further and into Russia, as we saw in Moscow, as you're insinuating, then the rules change a little bit, don't they? And then the interests change too. And maybe the security envelope might be extending as well, as Russia sees this as an existential issue rather than just something for its partners further afield. So is that what we're looking at?
Well, the thing is, in the past, it was the Israelis versus the Syrians rather than the Israelis versus the Russians. Now it's basically the Russians versus the Americans. The whole dynamics of this war has shifted and changed. And don't forget one thing. There was no deconfliction between the Russians and the Israelis. There was an agreement to a certain extent. If you don't fly over Syrian territories, we're not going to touch you. And if you want to fly over there, you have to coordinate with us, which means basically we will be coordinating with the Syrians and the Syrians can shoot you down. That's why most of the attacks that the Israelis have carried against, or the airstrikes that the Israelis have carried against the Syrians, happened from across Lebanese territories or the occupied Golan Heights. They fly over South Lebanon. From across our shorelines, they launch their missiles against Syria. And the same thing, they do it from the northern side of Lebanon as well. But they rarely go over Syria with their airstrikes. They strike Syria from Lebanon. Why? Because if they know if they fly over Syria, they will be downed by one of those sophisticated air defense systems. So what do? The Israelis take the whole Lebanese population hostage, human shields in terms of fighting the Syrians. The Syrians cannot retaliate over Lebanese territories to basically shoot down the Israelis, because one of those missiles might hit one of the Lebanese towns and kill Lebanese civilians. So the Israelis are taking the Lebanese population as hostages. At the same time, so long as you said the Israelis don't target Russian assets or interests, the Russians will actually not fight with the Israelis. They will keep it as Syria versus Israel fighting each other, whereas Russia would be basically fighting on the ground against ISIS and everybody else, like from the radical groups that were supposedly at one point or allegedly at one point or another supported by the Israelis and the Americans. And I'm not going to say allegedly anymore, because ISIS never apologized to anyone in the past. They only apologized to Israel for attacking Israeli troops. They said, oops, by mistake. That tells you one thing, that ISIS basically are in league with the Israelis. But let's put that to the side. The current fight that has expanded touched Russia at heart in Moscow. And the presence of the Americans on the ground, they've sent not only one, but two Delta forces. The first one got liquidated a few months back. And the second one was sent literally a week and a half ago. It's a kill team that's on the ground supporting the Israelis in Gaza. And those are the ones they were sent in to try to find Yahya Sinwar and other basically Hamas officials and PIJ officials and kill them and try to retrieve hostages. But I highly doubt that they want to retrieve hostages as much as they want to kill and assassinate the resistance in Gaza, the leaders or the leadership of the resistance on the ground in Gaza. That's one thing. The Americans are also building their own floating port. This threatens the extended interests of Russia in the Eastern Mediterranean region. I'm talking about I'm talking about basically the Russian military base in Hmeymim in Syria. So that's when basically the Russians have to make a move. And their first move to actually deter any escalation of the in the situation is to tell the Israelis, we are ready to basically engage in full fight against you. And here you go, we have moved our 10 battalions to the Golan Heights. Try to do anything. It's a message actually not to the Israelis as much as it's a message to the Americans that we are ready at any point to take part in that fight.
So if the U.S. are building this pier at this sort of the midway point of where northern and southern Gaza meet, and they're going to be stationing troops there, they're going to have military assets there. Do you think this is also the U.S. going between Hezbollah and Israel? In other words, in a way, this kind of, from an Israeli point of view, protects them a little bit to move a big U.S. set piece in there, because as we know, Hezbollah has the missile range to hit Israeli military assets that are parked or encamped around the Gaza Strip, if they so choose to. They have the range and the capability to do this. But with the Americans in there, that potentially might deter Hezbollah in the future if this conflict expanded. So two things. Is this a move that looks like it's portending a expanded conflict coming in the future? Or is this a move, is Israel using the United States? I know the U.S. has its own interests as well, but is in a way Israel kind of using the U.S. here to deter Hezbollah possibly? What do you think?
I highly doubt it. I mean, if you think about it, Hezbollah has missiles, long-range missiles that exceed 400 to 500 kilometers. The shoreline from Nakura and Lebanon, Ras al-Nakura, all the way down to the occupied Ras al-Nakura, which is Lebanese as well, all the way down to South Gaza, that's about roughly 300 kilometers, right? So it's beyond the Palestinian territories. They can actually hit beyond Palestinian territories. I don't think that an American military base in the Eastern Mediterranean would deter Hezbollah. The Americans tried to do that back in 1983. What happened? Do you remember the blast of 1983 that killed over 200 American and French soldiers who came into Lebanon as invaders and they went back in body bags? The same thing will happen over here, but not at the hands of Hezbollah, also at the hands of the Palestinians themselves. Do you think basically Hamas will be eradicated until now? The moment that the Israelis said that they withdrew from certain areas, you saw salvo of missiles coming out from North Gaza, from Khan Yunus, from South Gaza as well. So north, south, and central. And by the way, in the Zarim corridor that cuts off North Gaza, it cuts it off from central Gaza. The Israelis are trying to insinuate that there's only North Gaza and South Gaza. There's nothing called central Gaza. Central Gaza exists. It's a large plot of land that the Israelis are trying to also clear up and create a scorched territory over there. So the Americans are not building the pier. They had WCK and the Israeli military build that pier. According to the Israeli military and WCK themselves, they actually tweeted about that. The Americans are sending 1,000 troops to build a floating port in the sea. 1,000 troops to build a floating port, yeah, not civilian workers or architects or whatever it is. And they're going to control it to control humanitarian aid that goes into Gaza. If you want to send humanitarian aid to Gaza, you don't basically spend basically hundreds of days or like basically months in building a floating military port. What you do is actually open all the land borders and allow thousands of trucks that have been waiting for the past 6 months to go into Gaza and give that aid to the population. You will actually eradicate hunger situation and famine in matters of hours, not days, hours. But the Israelis and the Americans refuse that, which tells you that there's a malintention in this matter, malintention in terms of building that floating port because it's the nucleus for a larger U.S. military base. That military base can control certain aspects of war, but it cannot deter basically the resistance from attacking and inflicting real harm against the Americans. The Americans are very cocky. They haven't learned from their lesson in the past. They haven't learned from 1982 or 1983. They haven't learned from their losses in Horn of Africa back in the 80s and 90s. And basically, definitely, most definitely now they're showing the same cowboy aspect that they haven't learned the lesson over the past few months with the Yemenis actually slapping them. Do you think the Yemenis that are less equipped as opposed to Hezbollah?
I want to talk about the...
Yeah.
I definitely want to We want to talk about the axis of resistance, Yemen, also the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. We want to talk about them in the final part of this segment here. I'm with Leila Hatoum, veteran journalist, Middle Eastern based. We're talking about the potential escalation of a wider conflict right now, and we'll talk about that more after the break. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
My name's Stacy. I'm 57, and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home. The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mom, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Selbos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks. All right, we're back. We're back. Final segment of the first hour of this live broadcast here on TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us. I'm with Leila Hatoum. She is a veteran investigative journalist and reporter on the ground in the Middle East. And Leila, before the break, we're getting into talking about the axis of resistance, where things are right now. Now, with that sort of incident that allegedly happened in Jordan with the death of U.S. servicemen, that was a few months ago, that led to a U.S. Reprisal attacks against targets against the Islamic resistance in Iraq, and also PMU or Hashd al-Shaabi units as well. Things have been quiet on that front ever since then, but we do see a report recently of the Islamic resistance in Iraq saying they're ready to train or possibly equip resistance fighters in Jordan. So there are some things on the periphery here. Just bearing in mind what's happened with the Iranian embassy, and things are kind of in a waiting mode at the moment. Do you see things on that side with Iraq and also Yemen? What are your thoughts on those two areas now before we wrap up this segment? Go ahead.
I have to remind people that mainstream media doesn't show them everything. Less than a week ago, actually a few days back, the Islamic resistance in Iraq carried multiple attacks using attack drones that reached not only Amr al-Shrash Eilat in the Israeli entity, but also deep inside to Ashkelon and Asdod and other settlements inside Israel. They managed to inflict harm. They said that they have targeted one of the main energy ports for or run by the Israelis at one point or another. And the Israelis did not deny it. Those attack drones managed to fly without being detected by the radar system or the Iron Dome, and which this was a success. Most recently, we were talking about yesterday, there was a drone that was downed at one point or another by the Israelis, and they claimed they were actually rejoicing. For the first time, this was hilarious. The Israeli military was rejoicing that they managed to down one of the drones that was coming over to hit Eilat city, Umar al-Shrash. And the casualty is basically 15 attacks that went undetected, and they managed to hit their targets accurately. And then the Israelis down one drone. So it's 1 to 15. What kind of a success rate is that for the Iron Dome? It's garbage. $100 million system, defense system that basically can down one of 15 drones. Come on, give me a break. They couldn't even detect the other 14 drones or 15 drones. So the idea is that the Iraqis continue to fight on the ground, but it's not reflected in the media. What you get is basically there are attacks, there are sirens happening. And later on, you have a statement from the Iraqis. The Israelis try to do a hush-hush in the media, and nobody talks about it anymore. But we do have these documented incidents, and we do have the statements that were issued by the Islamic resistance in Iraq. So they never stopped. And the attack that happened basically against the Americans in Jordan, they actually, the Iraqis, it was, if I remember correctly, it was on January 27th, because I was in Jordan at the time. And the Jordanians didn't say anything at the beginning. The Iraqis said that they targeted the Americans while they were over the Syrian territories going towards coming back from Atanaf military base. And you have to remember, the Iraqis are the only ones who managed to kill American soldiers so far. Five at the beginning of this war, that the Americans later on claimed that they basically died in a helicopter crash, routine flight over the Eastern Mediterranean. And then three more during the attack on January 27th, on the mission that was coming from Atanaf towards the Jordanian territories. So that's one thing. They haven't stopped since then, despite the fact that the media tried to show something else. When it comes to the Yemenis, they continue to do, basically these people have not shied away from continuing to attack any ship that serves the Israeli entity or is taking merchandise to the Israeli entity or is protecting the assets, the Israeli assets or the Israeli entity. That includes American and British ships. And you have to understand that the Americans drew first blood with the Yemenis. They were the ones who attacked the Yemenis first. It's not the other way around. The Yemenis were not stopping American ships from passing unless they're going to Israel, to the Israeli entity. So the Americans came in and bombarded the Yemenis, and this is how they drew first blood. 2 days back, we saw seven consecutive attacks by the Yemenis against military and commercial ships in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. Most of them belong to the Americans and the British. And so far, the Americans have, and the British have been slapped. Their Navy has been, have been slapped left, right, and center. They are now the laughing stock. Their equipment, their multi-million dollar equipment, military equipment, are a laughing stock in the, on the international level, in the defense sector. They have lost contracts because of that. I mean, imagine you developing a $9 to $20 million drone with all the missiles that it holds and everything else, and you down it with a $5,000 missile. Or you have a multi-billion dollar ship or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Navy ship that you get to drown with one of your less sophisticated missiles. They do have torpedoes that can actually target the Israeli, British and American ships, not only in the Red Sea, but also beyond in the Arabian Sea and even in open waters of the ocean. So the Yemenis are doing their part. And this is something that the Americans didn't bank on from the beginning. They thought that they can actually hit the Yemenis. The Yemenis are already torn between their civil war and their poverty and the famine that's happening over there. Well, basically, they banked on the their own instincts, as we call them.
Well, this operation by Yemen, by Ansar Allah, has been very effective on multiple levels. It's also been effective on a diplomatic level because it's shut off whole routes that the United States was and Israel were trying to leverage politically, geopolitically, have been completely shut down by the Yemenis. And the as far as we've seen the reports, Layla, the port of Eilat is basically unusable. This is a major Israeli port. It's completely out of commission. So, and this is down to these various resistance factions. So very quietly, as the story you're telling here, Layla, is that very methodically, very systematically, strategically, very quietly, in fact, without the media fanfare, the axis of resistance has been working to close off and tie up some of these loose ends, has really taken away a lot of the advanced strategic and tactical advantages that Israel and its allies held in the region without any challenge for so long. Those have all been challenge now. And, you know, some people might say this is only the beginning. Layla, the Straits of Hormuz are still open, but they could be closed at a moment's notice. I mean, Iran has that power, don't they? And they haven't exercised it, which to me is quite extraordinary, but also shows the real power regionally that Iran has, because it's what you don't do that shows how powerful you are as much as what you do. So, but Layla Haitoum, veteran journalist based in the Middle East, we really appreciate you joining us on TNT, and I encourage people to follow Layla on X, Twitter as well, and do follow her because she's also speaking on many Twitter or X spaces as well. Very informative, open public forums where the analysis is discussed, geopolitics is discussed, and updates. And we appreciate all the work that you do, Layla, as well as your great colleagues. Keep up the great work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I appreciate your work as well. And thank you for having me again.
No, it's absolutely our pleasure. There she goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Leila Haitoum, a veteran journalist based in the Middle East. Really appreciate those updates. This is essential analysis because this is going to inform what we're going to see in the coming days and weeks in the region. And it's also going to inform us what we're reading through Washington and through Washington's allies. That's what this show is all about. We try to keep our listeners and our viewers a step ahead of what's going on compared to what you're getting on the mainstream media, which, let's be honest, it's not a lot. It's not a lot, folks. But listen, take a break here. Top of the hour news headlines coming up. And when we come back, we will hit the Burisma terrorism story as well as connect up with a great American commentator, Dustin Stockton, who's going to give us an inside track on the 2024 elections. All this and more coming up. I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll see you in a few minutes.